Well, welcome to Sheep Stuff You Should Know. This is Ryan Mahoney coming to you from Amy Tower 1, and today got my friend Dan Makin from what I first thought was the periodic table of elements behind your head, but turns out to be a calendar of the month of March. But how you doing, Dan?
Doing all right. How are you?
Doing pretty well. Pretty well. Busy.
What's going on in the Montezuma Hills?
Grass is growing. And it is growing and growing fast. It is really fun this time of year.
Did you get much rain last weekend?
Yeah, we did. We got about an inch, a little under an inch. We got, nice. Yeah, it was all in like 10 minutes, you know, just dumped on us and then nothing and then dumped. And it's just perfect spring rains for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about you guys?
We didn't quite get an inch, but we got enough rain to kind of freshen things up, and sounds like pretty good rain this weekend again, or end of the week. So
we had our biannual company meeting. We cover safety topics, you know, safety meetings, but then we also do a lot of different educational things as well. And this year we had a colleague of yours, Mr. Morgan Doran, came.
Oh, very cool.
And he showed off some pretty phenomenal Spanish skills and gave a whole presentation in Spanish. And what we covered was the grass growing, Kurt, like how grass grows, you know, fase uno, fase dos, and fase tres.
Yeah.
And it was a really cool presentation on the just grass, just basic information on grass, but then kind of really got into the reason why we rotationally graze and why it's so important to stock those animals up and rotate through when that grass is sitting in that phase two phase.
Yeah.
And don't worry about having too many animal units on pasture. Worry about the rest days.
Yeah.
And that it's able to come back. And so like it was really, I thought it was a fantastic meeting and discussion. It was a really cool presentation, and it was really cool because it's all, like I said, it's all in Spanish. So most of those presentations, you talk to, you know, the bosses or whoever it is, but like, you know, to actually get it for the guys that are doing the work to kind of connect the dots to why I emphasize so much, like you gotta mix those cows and sheep. You gotta let that field rest. You gotta, yeah.
What did the guys think of it? What kind of feedback did they have?
Well, overwhelmingly positive because I pay them. So I don't know. Yeah. Full disclosure, I don't know. I don't know what they talked about. And when they got home and they had their coors and hung out and were chatting around the fire, but everybody I talked to, they said he did really good and they appreciated it. And they were super engaged. I was really, one of the things I was really impressed with, because you know, we do really emphasize like teaching the guys as much as possible of the reason why. And I was really impressed with the correct answers that everybody had to the questions. Like they really knew, like they know the stuff. It's just they haven't been through the school and don't have a paper that says their name on it that says they know it.
Yeah.
But they know it, and they may not know the vocabulary for it, but they definitely know it. So that was really fun.
Yeah.
But
that's very cool. I may have mentioned this on another podcast, but with our guard dog project up there in Truckee with the sheep on national forest ground, it's always really fascinating to spend a day with the herder and just talk about what the sheep are eating and when they eat it and what they walk by and all of that kind of stuff. Because I think when you're out there all the time, you see things differently and at a greater level of detail if you're paying attention.
Yeah.
So
it's fun. It's fun too. Like there's one field, same thing, but we got one guy and he's really coming on as a really top husbandry guy. And last year we had this one field that the mustard really got away from us. And that same ranch, one of the fields, a star sticker got away from us. And Justin and I were talking, and we talked with him a few times about it, the employee. And anyway, we were talking to him, and basically what we said, or we kind of told him, or what we decided was we didn't really rotate the livestock through correctly. We didn't get the sheep on the mustard in that one field when it was still in the leaf versus after it shot its stem up. And then vice versa, the cattle didn't get in the star sticker field when that stuff before the spines came out. And And so those were, we have three fields on that ranch in our rotation. One had star sticker, one had mustard, and one was clean. And it was, you know, we kind of thought, you know, it has to be kind of rotationally based. So then this year comes around and the mustard's coming real strong and we start seeing those flowers pop up in that same field. And so then he's like, hey, we got to get some sheep over in that field to get the mustard down. And so we moved 700-800 into the field. And absolutely, I drove by there just now. And man, that mustard's getting knocked back real strong. Whereas the cattle are still in there and they aren't even touching it. They're laying down sleeping on it, but they're not eating it. So
that's funny. It's
really cool to kind of have those conversations with guys. And I mean, I'm learning too as I go through it. I don't have all the answers. Oftentimes they come to me wanting the answers, but I don't, you know, so much of it is all dependent on a thousand other factors, including what animals you have on the ranch at the time.
Yeah.
That it's hard to give an answer for all the years. And so to train that kind of understanding of the why, it really is cool to see it kind of blossom into some of these guys. And, you know, weaning weights are phenomenal out of that place. I mean, it's just, yeah, he does a really good job. So
the what is kind of the recipe. The why is the underlying factors behind the recipe. And
yeah,
I think you become a better cook when you know more than just the what, right?
Yeah. I was talking to my, that's funny you said, I was talking to my middle daughter. She was feeding my ego a little bit, telling me I was a good cook. And, you know, I told her, I said, well, you know, to be a good cook, you don't just learn recipes. What you learn is you learn flavors, and then you start cooking, and then you adjust the flavors based on what you know. So like, it's really important to try so many different types of food and things, and then watch how things are made. And then, you know, then you can taste something and say, I think that needs thyme or a little lemon or a little rosemary or a little this. And like, you're able to actually start applying those flavors to your recipe. And yeah,
that's
pretty cool. Same
that's
thing.
Very
sheep
cool.
Herding. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So hopefully is this going to get posted before Easter?
I have no idea.
We should still talk about what we're having Easter, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good segue, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Food and flavors. You want to go first?
What's that?
You want to go first? You got a recipe?
Well, I think you should go first. You brought up the food and flavor.
All right. Well, we're going to have, I'm hosting a lamb, Easter lamb dinner at my house. We have a family recipe that we've been making. My mom got it from, I think, the Anderson family, actually like 30 years ago. And it's a marinade. We butterfly it out and we really trim it back. We trim a lot of the fat off, where, you know, a lot of roasts, they'll butterfly it, but leave it open. We cut most of that fat off. And then, we soak it, and it's got lemon juice and olive oil, brown sugar, soy sauce, ginger. So it's kind of like this sweet, tangy type sauce. And we soak it in that for, you know, usually 2 days, maybe even 3 days, and then pull it out, strain the marinade. We strain it through a strainer, put it in a pot, boil it for 15 to 20 minutes to kill all the bacteria. And then that's served as a gravy on top of a barbecue. So we just kind of grill it, like Traeger it or Weber it.
Yeah.
Cook it like a tri-tip. Tri-tip is a what would you say? A 2-pound roast?
Yeah.
Cut of meat. It's a California cut. I never realized that till I went out of state that nobody knows what tri-tip is east of the Rockies.
When we were selling direct marketing beef, everybody'd want tri-tip, and you know, there's only two in a steer.
Yeah.
So I kept trying to breed cattle that had 5 or 6 tri-tips and
can't like never figured out how to cut the chuck into triangles.
Butchers would never do that for me.
Oh, gosh darn it. Yeah. It's one of those custom ones.
That sounds great. What else will you have with it?
We'll have Haggerty, which is Irish dish. It's scalloped potatoes with bacon and onions, basically, and cheddar cheese.
Can't go wrong with potatoes and bacon.
No, potatoes, bacon, onions, and cheese.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
But it's like the four major food groups.
Yeah. It's fantastic. And then, and butter. I forgot there's butter in it too. And then we'll have asparagus. Asparagus season is in full swing now. I just grabbed my first spears out of my backyard.
Nice.
And so we saw it in the store, the California stuff, and you can always tell those big, giant, fat asparagus. And so I'm excited for that. I don't know. My brother's making a salad, and my mom's making some desserts, and my daughter's making bread. So
nice.
Yeah, we'll just feast.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. That sounds great.
Yeah. It's pretty much the same dinner every year.
That's part of the fun too, right?
Yep.
Yep. Is there a year that stands out in particular that you got it just exactly perfect?
I always cook it perfect.
God, she really was puffing up your ego. Damn.
No, I don't have one day. I mean, you know, those dinners are always about the people.
Yep.
More in the food, but yeah. It's all good. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, what about you? Got some In-N-Out burger?
I think
you're coming to my house. You got an invitation if you want to come over.
I have been on the road so much in the last 3 weeks. I think I'm going to stay home and,
that'll be nice.
I might cook lamb burgers or maybe lamb shanks or something. I'll definitely have lamb on Easter. I had, 2 weeks ago, I was up in, Humboldt County and I got to visit the ranch that bought my ewes last year. And, they run about 300 mother cows, and now one of the daughters is starting a sheep and goat enterprise. So cool. Really cool to see that. And
where at in Humboldt?
It's inland from the coast. It's kind of between Neyland and Bridgeville.
Okay.
So above the Redwood Belt.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, really pretty country.
Oh, that's amazing up there.
Really pretty country.
Yeah. Don't tell anybody about it. That's some of the prettiest country
kidding.
In the world.
No kidding. We'll have to interview her one of these days because she's using virtual fencing on sheep and goats.
Oh, that's fun.
Dogs. And
yeah, we tried that. Some scam artist stole like $1,000 from us. It wasn't real, but I hear it's better now.
It's working pretty good for her. Pretty good.
Cool.
But anyway, so I took a leg of lamb up, and they celebrated a bunch of birthdays Saturday night, and. Yeah. Her husband said, well, you know, I'm more of a beef guy. I don't really care much for lamb, but I'll try what you brought. And of course we cooked it perfectly. And
best ever.
He had it and he goes, that's lamb. I didn't know that was lamb. That's really good.
Yeah. So, I have on my birthday, I had a little potluck dinner and I made lamb chops, racks sliced. So, yeah. And then I do it in like balsamic vinegar. And anyway, I made that for there's a one of my friend's girlfriends was there and she's I don't like lamb but I'll have one because you made it. So she had one and then she had another and then she had another. She ended up eating like four. I'm not telling anybody, don't worry.
We did that one year at our county fair. We served leg of lamb samples for people to try it, and we didn't tell them what it was, and like every other person would say, my God, this is the best tri-tip I've ever had.
Yeah.
How did you fix it?
Just like lamb.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, that's good. I got two other random questions for you before we get into our topic. We're going to go long on banter, but that's because it's fun.
That's good.
First, do you have a favorite brand of wool socks?
Because
I do.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
I've been reserving saying it on the podcast because I wanted to make sure, because I'm very particular about my socks and a lot of wool socks wear out quickly.
And, I am particular too. And I wear wool socks every day. You probably do too.
Yes. Pretty much every day.
365, unless I'm wearing sandals and even sometimes then.
Yep. Yep.
So for me, it's kind of a toss up between Farm to Feet and Darn Tough. I like both those brands, partly because they guarantee them.
Yeah.
But I also, they wear good for me.
That's good.
How about you?
Kent Wool.
Ooh.
I love my Kent Wool socks.
I'll have to check those out.
They're pretty amazing. These I've had these for like 2 years now, maybe three. I bought the first pair when I went back to South Carolina and I toured the mill.
Yeah.
And just, you know, you tour a mill and you always want to buy some swag and stuff. And so I was I'll go online, buy some of these socks, you know, show them a little love. They are the best socks I've ever had.
That's awesome.
Like, they're just like brand new now. And I got stinky feet and because I sweat a lot and because I'm Irish. And I like these, you can wear these 2 days, 3 days in a row without washing them. If you have the courage to do it, the socks themselves don't smell. It's just in your head and you don't want to admit to anybody. And so that's why I'm not going to tell anybody other than you that I do wear my socks more than one day at a time sometimes, but they're absolutely phenomenal. And they're actually all wool, which is like, that's, you know, one of the hard things on a lot of those wools are they're blended with elastic and stuff. So these are really, really nice.
I won't tell anybody else either, but I wear my socks 2 days at a time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a tough thing to admit.
I know.
Second question for you. Have you ever gone into a sheep truck or sheep trailer, gooseneck, and you go and you, say it's hauled quite a few lambs? And lambs, when they're loaded, you know, full, they tend to urinate. And when they urinate onto that it creates the sawdust, shavings, manure, dust with a bit of a smell, right?
Yes.
And when you get in there, sometimes you go and you're in a rush and you want to get the job done and no one else can do it right but you. So you just sacrifice yourself. You jump in there and you take your hands and boom, you put them right into that junk and you start crawling. And afterwards you get that smell, right? That stinky smell on your hands. Like, do you know what I'm talking about? Has this ever happened to you?
Yes.
And how long does it take for that smell to leave your hands? Even after washing them 100 times.
I'm not sure if it's still on my hands or if it's stuck in my nose at that point. I think it may be stuck in my nose.
All right. So, well, I got a plug for you. So this is, I discovered that if you use, and I like to hate on goats a lot on this podcast, but if you find some soap by Ridge Top Nigerians, which were graciously sent to us in the mail about a year or so ago, that soap gets rid of the smell. I don't know how it does it. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
So like, I have to tell a story.
Blew my mind.
I have to tell a story on Sammy now, because this happened probably when the girls were really small. You know, Sammy, being a large animal vet, on occasion had to put her entire arm somewhere that would cause it to smell that way, even with a sleeve on.
Yeah.
And we were sitting at church, and I'm sitting next to Sammy. It's about this time of year, I think. Sitting next to her going, "Did you wash your hands yesterday?" She got beet red and said, "Yeah, but it won't come off."
There you go. Ridge Top Nigerian goat soap. That's what you need. I don't know whether it's like the walnuts infused inside it or it's the perfumes that they use it, but whatever it is, my goodness, it was amazing.
Goat fat. It's
the
goat.
Be the goat fat. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I was impressed. I was very impressed because I did that today and I was, I had to show off. So I unloaded the third deck of a truck, you know, and I got out and I was like, this is a bad idea. But I did get my Chick-fil-A in about 3 minutes because I walked in and nobody wanted to be in. That stuff came out so quick. I was out of there so fast. So it does help accelerate, you know, your presence in crowds. But I got home and I used that stuff and I had washed my hands like 10 times, like 3 times in the Chick-fil-A. Yeah. I did it at the ranch with like that gristle soap stuff. Yeah. And then I came home and I had a bar of that on the sink. I was like, I'm going to use that. I bet that's nice stuff. And sure enough, absolutely phenomenal.
That reminds me of the movie Waking Ned Devine.
What's that one? I've never seen it.
Oh, you got to watch it.
Yeah.
You got to watch it. But there's a character whose name is Pig Finn. He's the village pig farmer. And the running gag in the entire movie is that everybody brings Pig Finn different soaps to try to get the pig smell off of him.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's such a unique smell that, I mean, even like the restaurant in town, like the breakfast shop in town, they're like, yeah, we know when you've been inside. We can smell it. Lingers. Oh, thank you. Good thing I tip good.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I always was sure to get a seat in my accounting class at Baylor.
Yeah.
Come in after livestock judging and move to the far edge.
That's fun. Good stuff. Well, now back to the topic. So we've bantered for 25 minutes, but it's always, it's so good to catch up with you, Dan. I appreciate the chance. And anyway, what I wanted to talk a little bit about today, and I don't know, it'll probably come a talk, it'll probably end up starting lecturing after a while, but we'll just get talking. But we're renewing our loan, our line of credit. And that got me thinking, we've done some business episodes and some things about stuff, but I wanted to talk maybe about money and money management and, borrowing and the purpose of borrowing and why it's important in business at a certain scale. And, did you ever account for cost of money anyway? And how did you kind of account for that?
Yeah, a couple of ways. You know, we did some small scale borrowing, when we were trying to ramp up. And so certainly accounted for the cost of money just in terms of interest payment. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of our balance sheet, you know, if you think of borrowing money to buy an asset, like buying sheep, that money you borrowed gets turned into a different asset, but the cost of using that money to get the asset is the interest cost. And so we kept track of the asset on the balance sheet. We kept track of the interest in terms of our economic performance. And then the payments obviously came out of the cash flow budget, whether they were principal or interest. Later on, like if I needed an infusion of operating cash before we sold lambs or something like that, and I could lend the money to myself, then I made sure that the business paid me back plus interest.
And what'd you use for your interest number? Did you just use prime? Did you just pick a number that you were comfortable with?
I just used a number I was comfortable with. I tried to say 5% would make me happy. If I had this in the bank and got 5%, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah, me too. Do you know a bank?
Not anymore.
They're charging 10 and paying out 3. But I think I might need to start a bank.
So how do you account for the cost of using somebody else's money?
Well, it's a budgeted line item in our budgets, but we never don't have a loan of some sort in the business. We feel it's very important. If you're going to grow your asset, you know, grow your worth, grow your equity, you need to be using capital from someone else, because if you end up acquiring too much capital, you tend to give it away in taxes. So if we worked on 100% our own self-funding, we would be declaring too much income tax at the end of every year and giving away, you know, whatever it is, 20-30% in income tax, versus using even bank money at 8-10% is still cheaper than the tax bill. So anyway, we always have it. And so there's a couple different ways. So you have cost of money was one of the terms you threw out there. And so for me, there's a couple ways to define cost of money. And just jump in anytime, or if you think I say something wrong or want to add to, please cut me off, because I am talking from the hip. But cost of money is, one, you have the straight, you borrow money, you have the interest cost. So it's the, it's whatever you have to pay somebody to borrow it. So if, you know, you buy a house, you get 5-6%, you go and you take an operating line, you're going to be 7-8%. You go out and get something at prime, it's going to be 8. So, you know, that's just straight interest. But then the other definition of cost of money that is very hard to calculate, but is a very real value, is your opportunity cost, or your, basically, if you take a dollar and I put a dollar into a sheep operation and I make that dollar worth $1.10, could I have put it into something else that would have made me $1.50? So it's kind of that, when you said, if I had this in the bank or in the stock market making 10%, is that better than doing what I did? And so you kind of, there, that's another cost of money. Is
so, Let me ask you this. How often do you think about opportunity cost in your business? Is that when you do
constantly.
Your annual? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, because opportunity cost is such a hard thing to actually itemize on a budget.
Yeah.
Because one, you don't know what you actually return till you return it. You can have a guess on what you might return, but you know, actually returning it is a whole different thing. And 99% of the time does not match your budget. Like if you're budgeting to the penny and it's hitting every single month, you're probably lying to yourself somewhere. Like it's unless you're running, you know, some of these hog farms and things like that, you know, you're able to hedge everything and have your ingredients and everything basically priced out 2-3 years in advance using different futures and stuff like that. But even there, you still have swine flu, you still have bird flu, you still have these disease outbreaks and things that change that budget. So no matter how much you budget everything, it's really hard to be exact. So,
well, and so I think that's a good point. I think, and this is maybe overly simplistic on my part, I think an economic analysis, which ought to include opportunity cost, tells us whether or not we should do a particular enterprise or a particular business. It looks at the fundamental economic performance of the business and gives you a way to compare it with other businesses. Mm-hmm. A financial analysis tells you how you're going to do it. Doesn't tell you whether you should do it. It tells you how you should do it. And that's where, to me, that's where a cash flow budget comes in. It documents your performance, tells you your sources of capital, your uses of capital, those types of things. Is that kind of what you're talking about here in terms of opportunity cost?
Yeah, no, you're rolling right into kind of the next thing, but definitely opportunity cost is just, it's that awareness of your cash flow and what you're doing. Like one example. So in our operation, you can take freight. Right, I can go and hire a truck for $400 for a local haul. They can, $400, whatever it is. So say $400 for a local haul. That truck hauls 50,000 pounds or 500 pound lambs. My goosenecks will haul 110 pound lambs. So that's 5 loads with the goosenecks. So my goosenecks, when I put a guy in and I run them 3.5 hours on a trip, on a round trip, that one trailer will cost me $100 just on a trip. And so if I have to take 5 trips, that costs me $500 to run my gooseneck. Or I can pay $400 to hire a truck. You hire a truck, right?
Right.
When you're managing your cash flow, the one thing that's lost in that equation is if I don't hire a truck, I still have to pay salary, I still have to pay fuel, I still have to pay maintenance, I still have to pay all those things for that equipment. So yes, it's cheaper apples to apples, but we're comparing oranges to apples and trying to make the best decision. And so sometimes if you have a light day, you're not as busy, you got things, you need to run those trailers and not put your cash into another thing because you've actually increased your cash demand. Even though it's cheaper to move the animals specifically in that job, your lost opportunity cost is in not utilizing the resources and the assets that are at your disposal in your operation. And so that's a really good example, in my mind, that's a really good example of how opportunity cost kind of manifests itself in an operator when you're thinking about how you're going to do things.
I think that's a really, really good example and an important point. I had kind of a similar conversation with these folks up in Humboldt who also have a logging business. And we actually went to a big logging equipment show, you know, $1 million pieces of equipment sitting out there.
Yeah.
And my friend Mark said, okay, let's think about this from where we are. We can log typically from April till October. So how am I going to cash flow a piece of equipment that I'm going to have to borrow a bunch of money to buy and only operate it 6 months out of the year? By the same token, they kept 2 guys on over the winter because they need them this summer, and they found jobs for them to do over the winter time so that they'd stick with a year-round job rather than going off and working somewhere else. So that's kind of a similar type of consideration, I think, in lots of ways.
Yeah. And I think these kind of decisions are where, when you get into like a very corporate type mentality, and things begin to be siloed, and even just small operators can do that, because you want to like, no, that's the sheep business. No, this is the cow business. We do that ourselves sometimes. Yeah. When you look at just the sheep versus just the cows make more money, but the sheep have so much crossover infrastructure use with the cattle.
Right.
That when you take that crossover out, all of a sudden now you're going to generate double the revenue on the same fixed overheads with cattle and sheep than just cattle. And so, yeah, like I said, if you look at it and silo it, you say, oh, we need to just run cattle. We should sell the sheep. Put it together. Oh, actually, the husbandry skills being learned by our guys lambing out 2,000 ewes a year is incredible, and adding 50 pounds a head on our calves that we didn't even know were there.
Yeah.
And so just like, there's so many little things like that. And so when you're building a budget and you're thinking about money, specifically cash, like the cost of money is very important. And it's important to be aware of that opportunity cost.
Can we put a pin in something and come back to it as another topic another day?
Sure.
I want to dig into that statement that lambing out 2,000 ewes puts 50 pounds on your calves.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that, because I think that's a really important realization.
It's very true. Yeah, it's very true.
So I want to dig into that. Let's just make sure that if you're listening and you think it'd be a good topic idea, help us remember to cover it at a later date.
Yes, I'm writing it down right now as we speak. It's terrible podcast radioing, but it's great for us for the future.
Yes, so, yes.
On our calves. All right. So now, next thing you said, we've mentioned a few times now, cash flow budget versus other budgets. So do you want to explain? There's two different budgets. And you can't.
What are the budget? How do you use those budgets?
So we have a cash flow budget, and you have an income statement, which is just your profit loss statement. Typically, that one's used for taxes. Your profit and loss includes depreciation. So it takes your assets. Income statement uses depreciation and how it assesses values to assets. The cash flow budget uses cash flow, so the cash spent in that period of time, as its marker for the budget. So if I go out and I buy a ewe, 100% of that ewe will show up in the cash flow budget. Only, what is it, 1/7 of the U or 1/5 of the U, depending on how your depreciation schedule is set up, will show up in your income statement budget.
Yeah.
And so they're both excellent tools, because depreciation is a very, very important and fundamental way to have a grasp on your assets. Yep. It's very easy to use that and manipulate it to make your taxes look better or worse, and lose track of where you're actually at in your values. But
it's something on a small scale that people tend to minimize. Mm-hmm. And so they'll get 7 years down the road and not have accounted for the use of that asset, and all of a sudden be out of the asset too. Right. So if you don't account for it in your profit and loss, you get a false idea of how profitable your business are, because you're essentially saying, I'm using that asset for free. And that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why you need to look at that income statement. The other function that an income statement will have that a cash flow budget will not have is death loss. So there is an actual expense deducted from your inventory books when you take a death loss that shows up in your income statement. There is no cash movement. When something dies, a $100 bill doesn't jump up and fly out of your pocket. It just, the animal dies and it's gone. And so there's no cash flow. You've purchased it through the cash going out to buy it or the money going out to raise it. And then it dies. So it's a zero. So on the cash flow, there's no movement of cash. So that doesn't show up there in your income statement. It does show up because it is a true and real expense to the operation, especially if you're accounting for your assets on a depreciation scale.
Right.
So when you're looking at how assets age themselves out, you need to take that annual death loss, so that way your assets stay current. If you don't take a death loss, you'll have 500 ewes in your asset sheet, and you'll only in reality have 300 ewes on the farm.
Right.
And this is a very real, I mean, we had this in our operation. We actually cleaned everything up. We've been working on, we did it over 3-4 years. That was one of the first things I did when I bought the company from the family, is I cleaned up those asset lists and brought them current. And so I took pretty high death losses those following years, and tried to space them out for different things. But we had to take them because they didn't exist anymore. We had to clean up that inventory. So,
well, and on the flip side of that, you wouldn't show a principal payment on your profit and loss, right?
Principal, yes. So that would be another one. Yeah, if you're borrowing money and then paying it back, your interest is expensed, shows up on your income statement. Principal payments are not.
But those principal payments have to come from somewhere, and so they show up in your cash flow.
Yes, and so and that's one common mistake I see very often when I'm looking at different things, is people make hybrid financial statements that blend cash flow functions and income statement functions. Yep. And I cannot stress enough for anybody out there that's trying to evaluate their business, do not mix those things. It's so important to not mix them, because when you mix them, you double count your assets.
Right. Right.
And you do that in the expense side or the income side, but you lose track of what you have. You just can't, you don't see a real picture.
How often do you look at your cash flow?
Monthly.
Okay.
Cash is king.
And do you look at your income statement monthly?
I do, but not in the depth.
Yeah.
So our budget is all based on cash flow.
Yeah.
So the budget that we turn over to the bank, that we function the whole year based on, that we base our borrowing on, is all going to be a cash flow based budget.
Yeah.
The income statement is essential. We absolutely need it, but it takes me half an hour to go through our income statement. It takes me 3 days to go through our cash flow statement. And and that's just because cash is king in a small business, period. Yep. If you're running a small business, your cash management is the most important thing to pay attention to.
You know, what occurs to me too, as you're talking about that, Ryan, working with and having done small scale direct marketing, where your cash only comes in when you sell a piece of meat at the farmer's market or to a restaurant. Unless you're really paying attention to both your income statement and your cash flow, you start chasing cash.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sheep business, that means maybe harvesting lambs at 90 pounds instead of getting them to 120.
Mm-hmm.
In the cattle business, that means harvesting animals that aren't going to grade choice. And chasing that cash will ultimately destroy your business.
And that's the other thing. That's the third part of the, we got the three essential parts of understanding your financing and what position you're in. Is number one, income statement. Number two is cash flow, cash generation. So when we evaluate our company, we look at those, we look at three things. We look at, do we have a taxable gain? And sometimes we don't intentionally, but we look at that. Number two, and this isn't, I guess if I'm going to put it in order, I want to look at the other way around. So I want to, cash generation is number one, equity increase at the end of the year, number two, and then number three is taxable gain. So those three factors are the three marks that are the most important marks in our business on, are we successful? Are we doing what we're supposed to be doing? Are we hitting our goal? Are we effectively generating positive cash flow at the end of the year? So is your all of your exercise from the year, are you generating value, generating cash? Number two, is our cash going into increased equity, or is it going into the bank? And both show up on that equity increase, but
And by going to the bank, do you mean, is it going to pay off loans?
Stacking in cash, paying off loans or being paid out salary, stuff like that.
Yeah, okay.
And then the third thing, that final thing, is that taxable gain. But the taxable gain, because there's flexibility built into that tax code on asset management,
right?
And that's an important thing, but it's definitely not the driver in most agribusinesses. So,
yeah.
And you don't want a huge taxable gain because you're taxed at, like I said, 20% corporate rates. So,
right.
Individual, you're taxed at 50. So, Yeah, you don't want to necessarily do that. So that, and that's why you have farmers that go out and buy new tractors on good years, right? You buy a tractor to get the asset, to get the cash, to then write it off all in that first year to balance out the tax. So
and
then you're running it for free because it doesn't show up in your income statement. But then your income statement looks good, but then you have a negative cash flow because you're not looking at your cash flow statement. You're just looking at your taxable income.
You got to look at all of it.
Yeah, that's
gotta look at all of it,
all the way down, and yeah, absolutely look at all of it.
So, you use like a line of credit or an operating loan that gives you some flexibility to make decisions during the course of the year.
Yes,
and then do you also have other specific loans for land or for equipment or other things?
Yes. So, yes, to all. Okay. So. Where should I go with this? Should we go? Let's go. I'm going to jump back to equity real quick and answer your point about, because I want to say something on your comment about equipment. So the other thing that we do to measure our equity value is we do a monthly, basically a monthly livestock appraisal is what the bank calls it, where every month we go through everything we have. We write it all down. We see the weights. We see where we're at. And we just, you take your debts, your feed and storage, just basically all of your assets, add them up minus your liabilities. And you see your loan to value ratio. And then we add in our fixed rate, fixed loans as well. So you look at your total liability in relationship to your total asset or total worth, net worth.
Okay.
And so doing that monthly is very important because if you do it once a year, and you pick the wrong time of year, you'll over-exaggerate or under-exaggerate kind of what you're worth. If you go and you evaluate cows, if I evaluate bred cows pre-preg check, so pre-preg check and pre-weaning, so you have a 600-pound calf on its side, and they're bred, you know, that you don't know how many are open, but they're all bred, they've all been exposed. That cow is worth a lot more than a post-preg check bred cow with culls out and no calf on her side. So if I take my ranch evaluation on May 1st and I compare it to my ranch evaluation on August 3rd, they're different. And a lot of that has to do with the state that they're in. Same thing with sheep. You know that when you take culls out, the animal itself is worth more dollars per head, but before you did the culling process, everything was appraised at the same level. Mm-hmm. And so you were overvaluing your culls. And so depending on what you have, it can change those numbers. So we do it monthly. Right. We do it monthly.
Okay.
And then we always, at the end of the year, we chart it out and look at our kind of average. And more importantly, we're looking at our average versus our loan to value ratios.
Okay.
So we look at our average and then we look at our debt because we want to stay within a range on our loan to value. And, you have your ideal range you want to be in, and then you have the reality of where you are and where you want to get.
And so, is that just looking at livestock inventory or is it also?
Yeah. So that's the other thing too, that I'm very strong on in my personal opinions. It probably is wrong from a lot of other perspectives, but equipment specifically, I don't believe should be in your evaluation.
Okay.
Vehicles, especially vehicles, lose value the day they leave the lot. And there's a lot of play in those. They also have wheels and can disappear. So if the bank's looking at them, you know, it's easier to grab a tree and put a lien on a tree that can't be uprooted than it is a cow than it is a car. Just in equipment itself, just like I said, it changes in value. I mean, just look at California and the CARB laws over the last couple of years and what it did to equipment values. Like, and that's legislative change that greatly affected values of things. So if you had a 1963 D6, you know, you had it on your books is worth, you know, $20,000 one day and $10,000 after CARB pass. So
at most.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of like those equipment things are really challenging to put on there. So I always do feed inventory. So, hay, corn, and that's because we have a lot of it. If we had minimal, we wouldn't do it. and we don't do our grass hay. We just do our alfalfa for our feedlot because it's a. I mean, we can have a pretty big chunk of cash stacked up in the barn. And with those price fluctuations and those commodities, it's important to watch.
Does that imply that your primary business, which is sheep and cattle, has to justify the equipment that you need, that the equipment is there to serve the sheep and cattle business?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And the equipment shows up on your income statement. So you will see it there. But when you're appraising the value of your operation, the other thing is your equipment, the values of your equipment should be fairly fixed, right? If you need a pickup truck in your operation, you will always need a pickup truck and it needs to be in decent shape. Right. And so that range, the value of that truck, it's going to be higher when you have a new truck and it'll be lower when you milk a couple years off it. But then you're going to buy a new one and then you're going to... and it stays fairly constant because you need one truck to do your job.
Unless you're Dan Macon and then you just drive that son of a gun into the ground. And
yeah. But then even still, what's it worth? Nothing. So why is it on your books? But yeah, no, whereas like the cows and the sheep, like those are the numbers. That's where your equity increases is in the sales of cattle, the sales of lambs. And so, it's cash plus your assets.
Well, and your equity increases as you, if you expand your sheep inventory.
If you expand it or you have a successful sale.
Yeah. 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 Uh-huh. Right. Right.
Absolutely.
But that asset then generates gain in equity.
Yes. Which is, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay. If you increase your number of ewes, then your ewes increase in value.
Yeah.
Theoretically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless the market turns.
But that never happens. The market's
not in the U.S.
predictable and kind of a straight.
Like the housing market. It's just always up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So anyway, so that's monthly statements. So with those three markers, cash flow, income statement, and the monthly evaluations, then we go and we look at our debt position. And so we have a revolving line of credit that we renew annually. And then we also have, I like to have fixed notes. So our line of credit, I like our fixed note to be about 10% of our line of credit. So we want to fix whatever that is, 10% of our borrowing. So if our debt to asset ratio is 40%, I want to have 4 or 5% on a fixed note and the balance. Okay. On a line of credit. We do utilize our line of credit. We try to build in buffers into it. You got to have a good relationship with your bank, which means you have to be honest with your bank, which means you have to be honest with everybody else.
Including yourself
and transparent and all those kind of things. And but we like to try to build a buffer into our line of credit. So that way with the sheep market, when you buy a lamb, you're selling it in 3 months if you're buying feeder lambs. So it's really hard to budget in March what the fall lamb trade is going to be. And if there's an advantage to buy 20,000 lambs instead of 5,000 lambs, then we want to have the ability and access to capital to do it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we budget it. And those kind of purchases, when you're buying feeder animals, you have a cash flow demand. You have an increased interest expense. That is super important to account for, even when interest rates are down. My grandpa always accounted for a 10% interest cost on every lamb he ever fed. He always would apply that. And I never understood it until 2 years ago. And now I understand why that factors in. Like it's a really important cost to just have.
Is that in essence an opportunity cost, really, that you're using as a budget? Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he'd use it on his, he wouldn't use it in like the budget presented to the bank or anything. He'd use it in the closeouts. So he would line item a 10% interest expense on the closeout of the lamb.
Yeah.
If you were to borrow the money to feed the lamb at 10%, that's what it would cost you.
Yeah.
So then the line of credit that fluctuates up and down based on your inventories, based on your, cash needs. We're doing a lot of buying throughout the whole year, a lot of selling at the same time. We're buying feeder cattle every week. We're buying lambs every once in a while, throughout once a month or twice a month, whatever it is. And then we're selling every week, both type of animals. So because of that, our line of credit, we operate it to try to make sure that our checking account is as close to zero as possible, or as, yeah, close to zero as possible, with that loan as low as possible. Yeah. We have one person in our office, pretty much her job, well, one of the main jobs she has is checking that three times a day and making sure it's paid down to the, you know, as low as it can.
Yeah.
Because that adds up to a lot of money at the end of the year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why it's important to get paid on time. Because if you don't get paid on time, whoever owes you the money is taking out a loan against you.
Yep.
And, you know, it's really important to recognize the cost of that and be respectful of that. You know, I pay my bills as quick as I can. I'd like to pay them immediately, essentially within 2 weeks of receipt. Livestock, you pay the day you get them.
Yep.
But then because of that, I always expect anybody I work with to do the same to me. Because if it doesn't work both ways, then all of a sudden I'm stuck floating money to the person I bought something from and floating money to the buyer. And that's just stealing, you know?
That's, yeah. And that happens even at a very small scale.
It happens everywhere. It happens at big scale too. And big scale, it's a lot of money.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and on a small scale, in a kind of a locally based circle of businesses, that word gets around pretty quick.
Yeah, it does. It does.
Pretty
quick. Yep. So, I don't know. That's kind of some basics on financing. You know, that line of credit is very, very valuable. One thing I really like about it is it's just having it forces us to be very diligent in our budgeting. And, you know, we're never right on our budgets, but we're always we're pretty close. When you look at the end of the year, do your comparisons, we're pretty close.
But having that out there kind of as something that you got to keep checking in with and that you have a particular goal for managing forces you to be diligent in the rest of your record keeping and the rest of your analysis too.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have taught some of this basic stuff through Cooperative Extension, but if somebody wanted to really dig into it and learn more about it, what have you found helpful in terms of learning how to do this type of thing?
I would actually, I mean, all honesty, I'd start with a bank. Like go to a bank and talk to a loan officer and understand some of the tools that are out there. I mean, their job is to sell that stuff, sell those tools. The bank makes money lending money, but they don't make money defaulting on loans, defaulted loans. They want good loans. And so education is a big part of their job. Most banks have a person kind of committed to customer relations, which is a fancy way of saying teaching you about stuff.
Yeah.
I know when I had an opportunity to go with Farm Credit West to a estate planning seminar at one time, that really helped. Any kind of intro to accounting class is super, super valuable. You just take it through a JC or online or something like that. But I took intro to accounting when I was in college and I use that class every day. I use business communication too, but that one is paramount. I mean,
see, we're coming back. If you go into your accounting class smelling like livestock,
Then you get away. Yeah.
You get away. That's right.
Yeah. It was funny. I that was my senior year. I took that class. And then my accounting teacher came up to me at graduation. She said, "You're a senior? You graduated?" I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "What were you doing in my class?" I was like, "I just learning." You're teaching life skills there. So, yeah, but it's good. I mean, because math is not easy for everybody. And I get that. I was blessed where math was pretty, I enjoyed it, but it's a hard thing to learn. And it's a foreign language. And when you get into accounting with debits and credits and depreciation and the way the financial statements work, it is a foreign language. So to think that you can just sit down and speak accountant, you know, day one on the job is, you know, you're lying to yourself. You need to learn it just like you learn Spanish, which means you got to immerse yourself or take classes or both.
And then you got to use it.
Yeah. You got to practice. Yeah. And so I'm still learning every day and I'm no expert at this. I mean, I'm thankful every day. I got John there helping me out because he keeps me out of some bad ideas sometimes and does a good job keeping stuff straight. I have a good accountant. The accountant is super valuable in that relationship too. And you got to have a relationship with your bankers, with your banker.
Yeah.
Or bankers. I mean, if you're enormous, maybe bankers, but I only have one banker. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's important to have those conversations and then never be afraid to talk to them. So like 2 years ago when the land market crashed, I called, you know, I don't know, we renew in June, and I called him in August and said, hey, this thing is crashing. This is going to be nasty. It's not good. I'm giving you a heads up. What do we need to do? And they said, just keep us informed. And we kept rolling through it. And, you know, there's no problems. If I tried to hide it and then all of a sudden come renewal time, I'm like, oh, yeah, guess what? We just lost a pile of money in the lambs. They'd be like, wait a second. Let's think about this for a minute.
Yeah. You know? So, yeah. Yeah. It's a lot like talking to your insurance guy, right?
Yeah.
You want to be realistic and upfront about your risks.
Yep, absolutely. Well, yeah, insurance is a little tougher nowadays, but you've got a good local one, then you're all right still. There's a few old school insurance brokers out there.
We have the pleasure of not being able to get fire insurance, even though we graze all around our place. And
crazy.
Yeah, it is. That's another topic down the road.
Yeah, liability is a big...
Yeah.
It's a sad thing. That does more to stop the economic wheels from turning than anything is insurance.
Does.
All right. Well, I got to go take my daughter to swim. So
I got to go talk to somebody about how to take care of guard dogs for a research project. So
fun.
I'd rather trade places. I'd rather go swimming.
I'm going to go for jogs. So
hey, it's great to see you. Great.
Good to
catch
see you
up.
Too, Dan. Take care.
This has been Sheep Stuff You Should Know with Dan Makin up here in the Asylum in Auburn and Ryan Mahoney and Amy Tower One down in Rio Vista.
Yes, sir. See you later.
See you later.